Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. Today I'm joined by film critic Jason Solomons, who's got the lowdown on some of the week's hot releases, including The Face of an Angel, a fictional take on the trial of Amanda Knox, Dior and I, a documentary which follows Raf Simons during the preparation for his first couture show as creative director at the world's largest luxury group, Dior. And we'll discuss Seventh Son, the latest fantasy adventure blockbuster to hit the silver screen. That's all coming up here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Jason, welcome to the programme. It's been a while. It's lovely to have you back on Monocle 24's airwaves.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
And an interesting selection of movies. We're going to start with The Face of an Angel, which is based on the ongoing trial of Amanda Knox, who was accused of killing her roommate Meredith Kircher in 2007. This is being released just as Knox's final appeal against her reconviction takes place in Rome next week. This is an interesting one, isn't it? Making a movie, a thinly veiled, I suppose, movie about real life events as they're still unfolding. How does this go down in the cinema?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the director, Michael Winterbottom, keeps trying to say, as he was when he was making it, saying it's not really about the Amanda Knox case, it's just something sort of like that, about a media circus and a trial. And yet it's called The Face of an Angel, which is the sort of title of the book by Barbie, the American journalist played by Kate Beckinsale in the movie. And that's the real life title of the book. So I think there's just, you know, and the film is dedicated, by the end, is dedicated to Meredith Kircher. So I think he's tried to do something personal about the creative process and about the sort of way that truth is never easily arrived at in a trial like this, as we can see, because the trial is ongoing. The sort of timing of this release is I don't know if it's on purpose. It's kind of lucky that they've kind of walked into yet another stage of this trial. And I think that, you know, it'll probably come out on DVD and the trial will still be going on, because what the film does very well is show how difficult it is to arrive at any verdict. And we all arrive at our own verdict because it's so mediated now that we kind of say, oh, well, Knox, she was a saucy one. Oh, look at her. She's definitely done it. And then the other one, we don't know, but we're all speculating. And I think what the film does really, because it posits, it's about a filmmaker who goes to try and make sense of a case like this. They've transferred it to Siena, Italy, not Perugia. So you know, that's how, that's how different it
there.
Is.
Yeah. And you can tell by the tiling that it's Perugia.
Exactly. and the food, of course, the regional differences.
Absolutely.
In the pasta
Come on,
sauce.
Jason, you know this.
And and it's all very, very well done. I think it's a sort of fascinating look at how the truth can get lost in these cases, and at how the media can be kind of at fault for kind of, you know, going for the salaciousness, specifically in the internet era where everyone's looking for hits and traffic. So, you know, you put Amanda Knox in and then of course that's going to get traffic. You put in sort of sex and death and all of those words kind of make your material more salacious. I mean, the Red Tops and tabloids have been doing it for years, but now in the era of the internet, everyone wants to kind of induce readership in some kind of way. So I think that there's an extra sort of layer there. And of course, this being a Michael Winterbottom movie, it becomes about Michael Winterbottom or Daniel Brühl, the excellent German actor who plays the part of the filmmaker who's gone to try and make sense of it and then gets lost in a kind of Dante's purgatory kind of inferno, it being Italy. He kind of starts reading Dante and gets lost in the kind of rabbit
warren.
Well,
that's a nice little aside, isn't it?
It's good. And then he starts getting, because there's much has been made in the case of the kind of drug addicted kind of party hedonism of the youth set that were in Perugia. Well, that's sort of going on in Siena as well, and that's how he comes into contact with the model Cara Delevingne, who's playing a girl called April, and she's really, really good.
Is she?
The big revelation of this film is that Cara
Delevingne... Because it's one of those funny things when you see Cara Delevingne in a Michael Winterbottom film, you know, an issues director, whatever, a very real director, and then you see Cara Delevingne, you go, really?
Yeah,
so that's
good.
That's a sigh of relief.
I'm sort of envious of her. I mean, obviously she's gorgeous and she's fun, but she's got a real natural sort of feel to her acting. She's got great charisma. She looks great, obviously, but she's very easy on the screen. And I think this. I don't know if there's a sort of an awards for this. There probably is, because there's awards for everything. Yeah. For whatever the best catwalk to big screen transfer ever made is probably her.
The crossover.
She's everything. She's, you know, she's a triple threat now, because she can walk and talk, doing it very well.
This is amazing. You'll be telling us next that the All Saints were brilliant in that weird sort of Guy Ritchie ripoff in the 90s. No, you won't.
I won't.
We're going to have a little clip of this.
Good.
And we should talk very briefly off the back of it. But this is Michael Winterbottom's The Face of an Angel.
Strange. When I think of The Face of an Angel, I always think of Elizabeth. Do you all mean Jessica?
We all use that line for Jessica.
Jessica is like a film star.
Oh, hey.
Blank canvas. Someone we project our fantasies onto.
She's the story.
Yeah, guilty or not, that's all anyone wants to read.
It's sad, but Elizabeth has disappeared.
Oh, look at that. He's got Jessica's diaries there. There's some flawless journalism right there.
Joe's very proud of his scoop.
You know, the police played a dirty trick on her when she was in jail. They told her that she had tested positive for HIV, so she had to write a list of everyone she had ever slept with. It's in there.
So that's the press pack, sort of around after the trial. They're all sort of having dinner with their regional different pasta, and they're all sort of discussing, you know, what the sort of ins and outs of the case. There's a guy from the Daily Mail. There's a girl from Reuters. There's, you know, there's the media pack there, and it's very good on that kind of camaraderie. Winterbottom's often done journalists in his films. That's why I quite like his films. They make journalists out to be sort of noble and heroic in some kind of way.
But Jason Solomon's as played as ever by Brad Pitt.
You know, that's exactly my go-to, my avatar. So, you know, he did it in Welcome to Sarajevo. He's done it in 24 Hour Party People, I suppose, with Tony Wilson. Yeah. So it's something that he kind of follows through, and he does it quite well here. And then it becomes very much about the filmmaker and his kind of coke-addicted, drunken struggles to not sleep with Cara Delevingne and to kind of get the film made, which, of course, he gets completely lost doing. But it's about that difficulty to find truth and getting lost on the search.
There's an interesting thing in that, the idea of sort of letting some daylight in upon the magic of the editorial process as a filmmaker, as a journalist. People like to see that on screen, not just journalists, but people like to see that, the almost taking a step back from the director's chair and seeing the director at work almost. You get a sense with that with some of Michael Winterbottom's films as well, don't you?
Yeah,
there's a finer line.
The apparatus is visible. They're kind of like backstage dramas.
It's a bit Brechtian,
in a way.
Isn't it?
But he did it with Tristram Shandy and Colin Bulstrode.
Yeah, exactly.
The sort of process seems to be interesting to him. I think actually the process to him is more interesting than the final product sometimes. Sometimes his films sort of finish halfway through and he's on to the next project. I mean, he's as prolific as any British filmmaker out there. But this film actually kind of does have a sort of thesis that kind of almost goes all the way to the end, except you can't, because the case that it's based on is ongoing, and the film sort of suggests that, and so it's an ongoing film, if you like. So that it's that kind of parallel world of truth and fiction and documentary that he's always straddled very well, and he does it really, really well here. And yes, Kate Beckinsale's good and Daniel Brühl's good, but the real star is Cara Delevingne.
Nice. Well, that was The Face of an Angel. It's out today in the UK, but not out until June in the USA. New from Michael Winterbottom. We're going to get even realer now as we're moving on to a new documentary. It's called Dior and I, and it follows Christian Dior's creative director, Raf Simons, as he launches his first haute couture collection. I should have just done it in English, shouldn't I, really? I always stumble. Nonetheless, let's have a clip of this, and then Jason Solomons will talk us through it.
Raf wasn't the obvious candidate. People said, oh, he's a minimalist.
I feel very humbled to stand here.
Find a legacy of Dior, all of challenging.
Ooh la 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 la. Ooh.
I have an idea, but it's very extreme.
I want it to be dynamic, because I find women very dynamic.
How fast can they make a jacket like that in black?
Oh, no.
How fast can you make a jacket like that in black?
It's a little bit of a spot the difference between that and Bruno.
It is. And the funny thing is that trailer sort of makes it feel a bit like Bruno or Zoolander or something. Yeah. And actually, the reason that this film is good is because it's not like that at all. It's actually very serious about the business of fashion. It really goes behind the scenes to see the seamstresses, every stitch of the way is there. And the pressure of putting on a new collection and the serious business of fashion.
The huge responsibility to your shareholders, to these huge mega brands.
Yeah, and Bruno Arnault, who's head of LMVH, sort of comes in every now and then. It's all over. Well, Bruno's, will we get it past him? And they even sort of...
And he's called Bernard.
Bernard, indeed.
But I like the way he's Bruno, been Chris
everyone's Bruno.
Bruno
in fashion. You're right, Bernard, you know, is there. And so it's all about that, you know, and this is a big, big thing. The thing with the film, which is called Dior and I, and it's directed by Frederick Cheng, who did a great fashion documentary about Diana Vreeland before, and did the Valentino doc about the last emperor, about Valentino, which was about sort of how ridiculous fashion is and how grand it is. This one isn't. This one's very... Because Raf Simons himself is very sort of humble and shy, if you like, and he doesn't do all the kind of ridiculous Zoolander stuff. He's the sort of the humble stuff. So what we're seeing is a great leader, sort of executive decisions, how that comes through and how you organise a couture collection, his first actually, because when he was at Gilles Sander, I think they needed Prêt-à-Porter. So this is a big
his
sort of step for him.
Zoolander.
I know, and he's kind of, but how's he going to do it? You know, I don't know how he got the job. The big elephant in the room the elephant dans la chambre, is they don't mention why Raf Simons has got this job.
Because they even ask it in the clip there, don't they?
Yes,
in the trailer.
They sort of say, well, you know, he's a strange choice. And he was, because he wasn't that well known, and certainly not particularly for women's wear. But the reason
because
he got
the biggest job in fashion, presumably.
Yes, and he got it because Jean Galliano didn't get it anymore, because they just got rid of Galliano. And they don't mention Galliano at all, not once, about
which
this
is strange.
It is a bit odd, given that that's what
does
I
that take anything away from it? The fact that if you know anything about fashion, if you just Googled some of the issues behind this thing, that would be the first name that would pop up on your Google search.
I think it would.
I thought
that was odd. You know, it took me a while to sort of think, well, why did he get this job? Why are they looking for a new creative director? You know, normally this is the normal churn of business, but actually this is a big thing, and that's why Dior was sort of rudderless for a while. And then he comes up with this fantastic collection, which was beautiful, amazing stuff. He did some brilliant stuff with Sterling Ruby, who's an American artist, and he'd done some brilliant stuff with the threads of it. I mean, it looks amazing. And then this wonderful show, kind of old school show, because they're not the same as catwalk shows. They take place in maison particulier, and they're gorgeous, and there's flowers everywhere, and they wander through, and then there's a big fat Harvey Weinstein sitting in the front row next to Jennifer Lawrence and Marion Cotillard. And then it gets a bit sort of like, oh, who are these people? But it's not one of those kind of skinny models backstage kind of movies. It's really about the work that's gone into it with these seamstresses who become the sort of secondary players in this movie as well. And also, the layer of what's intelligent about the movie is that it's about the ghost of Christian Dior, who kind of is allegedly haunted.
I hear that he kind of comes back as a little Greek chorus.
He haunts the building. Anyway, it's on Rue Montaigne and Avenue Montaigne. And he, apparently, the people who work late at night sort of hear Christian Dior sort of padding along. And so his memoirs.
I wouldn't
have worn
that with that.
Yeah, he's like, I can't believe you're doing that this year, peacoats. Yeah. Ridiculous. But that kind of plays very much on Raf's kind of creative decision. You know that you're inheriting a history here. And so Dior's own memoirs kind of waft through it, and they go back to Dior's old house, which is pink and lovely. So it's a very sober-minded doc, considering the sort of expense and flamboyance that is at its core.
One of the questions I always think when I watch these sorts of films is, why were they made, actually? Do you think this is a nice PR exercise for Dior, the sort of post-Galliano Dior? Do you think that's one of the reasons it was made?
I think that's why they kind of excised Dior out of it, or excised Galliano out of it entirely. So I think, yes, there's definitely that's why they agreed to do it, because otherwise, I mean, you've got a couture collection to make in 8 weeks. You don't want a camera crew hanging around. But he does it very well, and he's become sort of the fashion guy, Frederick Chen, that I think they've got some trust going on as well, and they didn't make he understands fashion, and I think fashion is a very good subject for the movies. It kind of translates very well. You've got gorgeous glamour, you've got kind of hard work, you've got some a fantastic kind of event at the end of it. It's almost like a ticking clock kind of movie. You've got kind of, can he pull it off in 8 weeks? And yes, he does.
And presumably in that movie, the one we just talked about was Dior and I. It's by Frederick Chen. Presumably that is the way to find the next Cara Delevingne, who's going to be the next big actress.
Yeah, I couldn't spot one in here. There's one called Esther, who's quite good. But whether she can act, I don't know.
You heard it here first on the Arts Review with Jason Solomons. The third movie we're gonna finish with, actually, is a blockbuster. It's Sergei Bodrov's fantasy action adventure. It's called Seventh Son. It stars Jeff Bridges, Julianne Moore and Ben Barnes. Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore, two people we don't necessarily think of as action adventure. We've had them up for Oscars for some more serious roles.
This is it, isn't it? Yeah. You're absolutely right, Rob, because, you know, you win an Oscar, you wait all your life to crown your career with an Oscar. Jeff Bridges nominated 5 times, finally won in 2009 for Crazy Heart. Julianne Moore won only last month, and her Oscar-winning performance in Still Alice is still out in the cinemas around the place. And you think, Oscar winners, brilliant. And what happens now when you win an Oscar? You used to crown your career. It's now become a curse. Because what happens is your stock goes up, your money goes up, your renown goes up. Your agent, who's stuck by you as you've chosen all these god-awful cheapo indie movies throughout their career, suddenly you win an Oscar, and they start bunging you into loads of blockbusters as quickly as they can to make capital out of this Oscar you've got. So Jeff Bridges hasn't been in a decent film since he's won the Oscar. And you wonder if that's going to happen to Julianne Moore, because now here they are together at last.
Proving a great journalistic point about
Oscars being nothing. And the last time they were together, I believe, was in The Big Lebowski.
That's
a good bit of triv.
Yeah.
But, you know, so you're all that way. And now here they are, plonk in this nonsense. I mean, fantasy genre at the best of times is fairly nonsensical. This manages to kind of, you know, turn it up to, well, I suppose seven, really, because it's called Seventh Son. And it's in it, Jeff Bridges
should be called Eleventh Son, maybe.
It really should be, because it might as well be. I mean, it's directed by Sergei Bodrov, who's done some good Russian movies, kind of muscular epics, really, in a way. He's clearly got no feeling for this genre or the dialogue at all. He's a knight, a demon hunter called Gregory, who's got an apprentice played by the vapid Ben Barnes. And then she's the queen of the witches called Malkin, and she wears a lot of eyeliner. She's got flaming hair, and she turns into a dragon every now and then. And then Olivia Williams turns up looking worried in Hessian, and probably because of the Hessian, it's very itchy.
It's very itchy.
Yeah, she looks like it's really kind of uncut. She's probably got underwear out of Hessian in it. And then
that's
the dragon,
method. That's very method.
And then Jaimon Hounsou turns up on a horse, and everyone runs away. And I could make heck nor tail of it. See if you can.
You are worthless. There's not enough time. You'll be dead in a week. Good aim.
I was aiming for your head.
Missed.
That is Jeff Bridges.
That is Jeff Bridges becoming, as every day goes past, more and more like Brian Blessed.
I was trying to work out what he's talking about. No one has any idea. And he's got this kind of... I think he's trying to do Gandalf and sort of kind of give it a bit of gravitas because McKellen got away with it in his nonsense in the Lord of the Rings stuff. But he's really turning into Winston Churchill doing Yoda, I think. it's just embarrassing. Poor Jeff.
It does sound a bit like... It sounds a bit like a bad impersonation of Winston Churchill fixing a photocopier or something.
After a lot of Johnny Blacks.
Yeah, exactly.
So, it's a real mess and it's loud and noisy. The dragons, I suppose, are quite good. I couldn't work out who was in a dragon. Some good dragons and bad dragons. Everyone's jumping over cliffs quite often. They do it like three times. It's like the falling over the cliff moment. You're like, well, once is enough. And then they do it again and then a monster.
I think we know what's going to happen next time.
Exactly. And Ben Barnes is... And then there's Alicia Vikander, the Swedish actress, who's very beautiful.
Yeah.
But she... And they... You know, the thing with Alicia Vikander is that she's a very good actress, and she was very good recently in the Ex Machina, where she played a robot, sexy robot. But they've kind of given her a sort of busty damsel dress, and no offence to Alicia, but it's not her. That's not what you're known for, love. And she just keeps trying to heave out this garment, and you're like, well, there's something missing. At least CGI those in like they did for Keira Knightley and Arthur.
If they can turn Julianne Moore into a dragon,
anything is indeed possible. Unfortunately, you cannot do that to the script.
On that bombshell, I think that's enough of Seventh Son. That's new from Sergei Bodrov. It stars Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore and Ben, the vapid Ben Barnes, apparently.
Put that on the poster.
Yeah, put that exactly.
But then I suppose the moral of this story is don't win an Oscar because you'll end up in big budget nonsense.
No, they are. It's all of those things together. We talked about Seventh Son. We talked about Dior and I, and we talked about The Face of an Angel. Jason Solomons, thank you very much for talking us through those new movie titles. You've been tuned in to the Monocle Arts Review. I've been Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time on Monday when Gillian DeBias and Sue Stewart will be talking photography. For the time being, have a great weekend, and thanks for tuning in.